thanks very much. It's great to be here. Had a wonderful day so far. So I am going to talk about maybe not quite flawless flocking. I want to talk about how we've taken in my group a rigorous look at the nonlinear dynamics of collective animal behavior. So while maybe they're not flawless, we know that, or maybe you've observed that animals at the level of the group do pretty remarkable things when it comes to, for instance, foraging, predator evasion, migration. They do things that individuals couldn't do on their own. And they've also been observed to do them in ways that look remarkably fast, remarkably efficient, remarkably robust to what must clearly be a lot of uncertainty, and remarkably adaptive to changing environments, all things that one might like to understand. And so what I'm going to tell you a little bit about today is the work we've done in deriving models, models that somehow are rich enough to capture the mechanisms that might explain what relatively limited individuals do that yield collective behavior that's quite remarkable. And at the same time are simple enough to be tractable for analytic purposes. So we want to do systematic analysis of these kinds of mechanisms and understand the connections between individual behaviors and group level behaviors. And I'm going to talk in particular about a perspective where we look to at the nonlinear dynamics and try to derive a bifurcation analysis. So what we want to be able to do is understand how, you know, the group level performance depends upon, in very systematic ways, a simple number of parameters that either define the system or define something about the environment. So this allows us to draw insights, allows us to think about prediction, coming up with hypotheses that could then be studied. It also, I'll argue, allows us, so I'm a control theorist, as Anton mentioned, it allows us to think about sort of the related design problems. So what if we were to try to enable, say, a network of robotic systems to do something at the level of the group? So I'll just show you a couple examples. In engineering, this problem of coordinating the control of individuals, I mean, I have shown you an example of a power network or a synthetic biology network, or networks of, these are underwater gliders that we've used in the ocean to do sampling observation. And here the idea is, just like in the natural world, when we think about bird flocks and fish schools, each individual is limited in what they can sense, in what they can do, what they can compute at the individual level. But if we could somehow design in, you know, sort of judiciously the interactions and the response to what others are doing, what's going on in the environment, then at the level of the group, we would hope to do something maybe nearly as remarkable as what we see in the animal world. And so we look to the animal world, and because, you know, you can think about this, this is a beautiful flock of a couple of thousand starlings that are roosting or moving over the train station in Rome. Actually, that big bird was a predator, a falcon, and it's just absolutely phenomenal. You look at these guys, each one is probably quite limited in what it can sense and what it can do and what it can compute on its own, and yet as a group, they move almost as one. You don't even splinter in this kind of setting. Here's another video. I took this one off the web, so I don't know who to attribute it to, but there's this beautiful patterns that are formed by these schooling fish. So now you see them moving in this sort of toroidal pattern, and then at some point, whether it's maybe somebody has decided that there's something of interest, or a couple of them have decided, they move into a more polarized motion. So this, all this beautiful pattern, beautiful kinds of structure going on at the level of the group, and yet individuals are relatively limited. And so we'd like to understand what's going on. In the biology literature, there's kind of a strong coupling between what's known as the mechanistic approach, which is where they try to understand how the group behavior is being produced, what are the mechanisms, and then the functional approach, which is trying to understand why these group behaviors have evolved in terms of natural selection. So it's very important to keep both of those things in mind as one asks these kinds of questions, because even birds and fish may be doing very different kinds of things because they have very different selective pressures on them. So the strategies that they've developed and the things that they're doing, while sometimes they might look at the group level very similar, it might be very different kinds of mechanisms underlying them. So in the biology literature, there's ubiquitous models that individuals use, so that individual researchers use to think about how individual agents or fish or birds interact with one another. And so I'm showing you just a couple of them here. And because they think that the collective behavior emerges and is influenced strongly by essentially who is paying attention to whom, it's careful work to try to understand how to come up with that sort of sensing paradigm, who can see whom or who can smell whom and how they respond to them. So on the left is what's known as the metric distance model, and it's or a zonal model. And so the yellow fish in the center is the focal fish, and the idea is that there's some kind of radius, and when the radius is in this first region, they would maybe move away from individuals so they don't collide. Then there's this second annulus where if they see neighbors inside there, they, you know, it's a happy distance, maybe it's a body length distance, and so then they would just align. And then in the larger annulus, those are the ones that are a little too far for comfort, so maybe they move towards them, and then outside there they don't sense them, something like that. That's the zonal model. In this model on the right, which maybe you've heard about because this was promoted by this group of physicists in Rome who studied those starling flocks, they call this a topological distance model. So now the focal fish isn't paying attention to everybody within a certain distance. They're paying attention to a fixed number of closest neighbors. So they're paying attention to their M closest neighbors. And this was a really beautiful paper that came out in 2008 after studying for a couple of years these the starling flocks, like in the movie I showed you. They used this lovely story that was related to an anisotropy. So they studied where the first closest neighbor was located radially, overhead or front or back or sides. They found that they were the first closest was here or in the back at an angle. And then they studied where the second closest neighbor was, the third closest. When they got too far away, it became isotropic. And so they argued that the distance interaction decayed with distance, and they also argued that you could use a measure of anisotropy to determine who an individual was paying attention to. And then they showed over these many, many flocks that, and many, many flocks that had different densities, that it was precisely a fixed number of neighbors and not a distance, because it wouldn't have made sense with these different density flocks to pay attention with only a certain distance, because at some point you would have no neighbors. And they were able to show that basically things became isotropic when you got to something like six or seven neighbors. So just to give you a little sense then of, you know, the influence, well, not yet the influence, but the change in how you define your sensing paradigm and the network structure can change very quickly as you make these kinds of changes. So here every blue circle is maybe the position of an individual, say, fish or bird. And suppose the guy in the center of the purple circle is our focal individual, and he's paying attention to everybody within some fixed radius, so everybody inside the purple circle. And now I've applied a purple circle to everybody. And so I get these, you know, bidirectional arrows, because every pair is sensing each other, because everybody has the same radius of their sensing circle. The one guy outside is too far away to sense anybody. Now if I assume that there's some kind of blind zone, they can't see anybody behind them, and suppose they're moving this way, then a lot of those bidirectional arrows become unidirectional, because you can't see the guys behind you. So already it's a very, very different kind of flow of information. And then if I use the topological metric, so here I have the very same points, and everybody's paying attention to their two closest neighbors. So now the guy who was left out can sense these two, just like in the starling flock. And then again, yet a totally different kind of network. right. So one of the particular things that my group, my students and postdocs and I have been interested in is the role, explicitly the role of this interconnection topology. Who is sensing whom on what emerges at the level of the group? And so I've just defined a little notation because it'll come up again. So here we would define, so the kth individual here is paying attention to the jth individual, and he's putting the weight AKJ on the information that he's receiving. Okay, and you can actually encode an entire network this way. So if there's no sensing, then that weight is just zero, and you can just construct a matrix out of these weights. And if you manipulate them a little bit, you get something called the Laplacian matrix. So it's just an n by n matrix. We have n individuals, and we just encode who's sensing whom inside this matrix. Turns out to be very useful in the following way. So one of the I want to tell you just a couple quick stories before I start talking about models. And we'll talk a little bit about how we use our system theoretic approach that might be quite complementary to some of the things that you think about in statistical mechanics. So this is actually a collaboration with the folks who worked on the Starlings to help or to contribute to answering this question that came next, which was, why would an individual bird pay attention to 6 or 7 and not 8 or 9 or 4 or 5 of its closest neighbors? And we had been studying this problem of trying to understand the role of the network topology, so who's sensing whom, on the ability of the group to agree on something, to come to consensus or synchronize in the presence of uncertainties. Okay, so here the idea was, what if we just looked at the simplest possible kind of consensus dynamic, which I've written down here, which is just a linear consensus dynamic. So the kth individual has some variable that it's trying to estimate. So it could be like the bird's, which way the bird is heading. Okay, so xk could be the kth guy's direction. And he's updating it, so this is just a differential equation. He's updating it based on the relative measures of the neighbors that it can sense, the xj minus xk, the relative headings of its neighbors. Okay, I mean, this could be anything. They could be agreeing on a temperature and then just updating if they could measure the relative temperature of somebody else. Okay, so you can write it like this, or you can write it in a as a vector x here. The Laplacian matrix is precisely the one that gives you x dot equal minus lx. So that's just the encoding of all those akjs in the right kind of way. And in this perfectly deterministic setting, the solution, the equilibrium, as long as there's enough connectedness among the individuals, will be such that everybody converges to the same value. Let's just call it x bar. Okay, or you could write it as the vector of where x bar is a scalar times a vector of all ones. Okay, so we asked the question, what happens if there's uncertainty? And we just modeled that as, so in this equation, well, I do have a pointer. Dx equal minus Lx dt, and then we add just a Wiener process with everybody having the same identical amount of variation, same kind of, same intensity noise, additive noise. So now the idea is that I'm getting this, the bird's getting this measurement, but it might be a noisy measurement, I don't know exactly which way this other bird's heading, or maybe it's uncertainty in what I do with that information as I update my own state. Okay, so then the question was, so we know we get perfect agreement with connectivity without noise, and so with noise, there's going to be some kind of random walk about connectivity. So a really natural thing to do is to ask, what is that? In fact, we look at it at steady state. What's the steady state dispersion of the group? What's the steady state variance about agreement at steady state? Okay, so this for us is a really interesting measure of robustness. It's actually a very natural measure that we study all the time in control theory. It's called H2 robustness. But it gives us a measure of how a particular network can manage to come to agreement in the presence of uncertainty. And what's more is that using just a little bit of mathematics, we can actually compute the steady state covariance matrix and then take the trace of this matrix, which gives us the dispersion of the group about agreement at steady state. And we can do that simply as a function of, this is just a projection of our original Laplacian matrix onto the space orthogonal to the agreement space. And we have this encoding of our network structure. So if you know who's sensing whom, then you can compute this measure of robustness. Okay, so our idea was to then use it to distinguish six or seven neighbors from four or five neighbors or three neighbors or two neighbors in the context of these starlings, right? I mean, what's nice about this, which is a little bit different from the way one might approach it from statistical mechanics, is that we can allow for this directedness. We don't have to have a symmetric kind of interconnection, right? So I can sense you, like six would be my six closest neighbors, but I'm probably not any of your six closest neighbors. So the arrows would go this way, and then your arrows would go the other way. And so that's, we can handle that in this kind of context. And so what we did was take the something like 394 snapshots that these folks had of these starlings, so across 12 different flocks, and then we looked at their hypothesis, was that each individual pays attention to its m closest neighbors, and we computed this for m equal 1. We got one network structure. M equal 2, we got another network structure. So in each case, we could compute this score. You know, we could compute just how robust they would be at steady state, given that network structure. And so what we found, actually, let me just explain what I'm showing you here. This is this metric, the inverse of this metric. So that higher is better now. And it's also normalized by the number, because in each of these flocks there's a different number of birds, partly because of the occlusion in when they collect the data. And also, we've divided by the number of neighbors to try to understand what the advantage is to adding an additional neighbor. So this is sort of robustness per neighbor. Okay, does that make sense? And what we found, quite interestingly, was that the average of all these 394 is this blue curve right here, and we found that it peaks at 6 to 7 neighbors, which was really quite exciting. It gave us some justification for thinking about this as an interesting metric, because there's so many different ways to model robustness. But it also helped us to think about maybe robustness in this sense was something that the birds are trading off. It leads to lots of other questions, like why would a bird do something that was good for the group? So maybe thinking about this from an evolutionary perspective is a next step to think about how an individual, for its own fitness, might have evolved to a strategy to pay attention to that many. We also looked at the fact that we had different shaped flocks. So these flocks are 3D, but they're not very 3D. So they're like a few birds deep. They're kind of like fluffy pancakes. And it was kind of an interesting question, you know, what is it about the shape of the flock or the way they've distributed themselves that they are six or seven make sense in terms of robustness? And so we found that what was a meaningful distinction was this thickness. So if you just measure, you know, the dimension, the sort of the thicket, the smallest dimension over the largest dimension of your flocks, and you plot, this is just the absolute measure of robustness as a function of thickness, you see this kind of trend that, you know, the thicker they get more robust. They all sort of live in this range, so we also looked at sort of artificially constructed flocks taken from uniform distributions, and we found that, you know, it's not so great to be a sheet. It's much better to be 3D, but you don't need to be very thick to do well in terms of robustness. And what was sort of remarkable was that the birds were kind of living right around this place where they could get all the advantage to being thick, but not being so thick that they might have some problems aerodynamically. Other people have shown it's not good for flocks to be big round balls, or certainly not cubes as they fly around. So in the interest of making this fun, as I was instructed to do, I'm going to tell you one other little story before I get to a model. And that is, so I collaborated with a choreographer. And the idea was to try to understand, I mean, this actually turned into science as well, but the original idea was artistically to understand what happens when dancers who've been trained so that you can give them these kinds of rules that we use to model flocks carry out these kinds of roles. So in this case, we worked with her dance company in New York, and then we taught a course. So these are a dozen students, there's actually 13 people out there, some professional dancers, who were told to, you know, move around and stay, you know, arm's length from two others, not let anybody else get closer than two others, and then just go. Let me just show you the movie. I mean, what's really exciting is that, unlike the starlings, where we can only hypothesize about who's paying attention to whom, these guys were actually paying attention to two closest neighbors. And so when we digitize this video, we can back out at every time frame who's paying attention to. We can get the network graph. We can see how the network graph evolves. It's so, you know. Yeah, you get all kinds of weird things that happen. Sometimes the group splits. In fact, let me just see. Yeah, so here's an example where, we did tracking. So this is just one frame, and so we know where the position of, you know, the hat is and the direction of motion. And so we can, you know, plot this. So we have you could see a movie of the moving positions and the moving arrows. So we know how the graph changes. The network structure changes at every time. And then you can compute all kinds of things, right? So one of the things we computed was something called node status, which is basically average of the inverse distances of neighbors. So here, just assume all the weights are one. And if everybody is looking at me, if I'm one of the two neighbors for everybody, then my status would be one, because they're one hop away, so I sum up. N minus one guys divided by N minus one. If no one's looking at me, it's zero. And then, you know, if somebody's two hops away, they contribute a half to my average. And so those little numbers are the node statuses of these individuals. But then you can do other kinds of things, like look at, one of the things we did was we were able to find moments when certain people had high node status and correlate that with, you know, lead and lag time when the group turned. So somebody who had high node status was correlated with turning before the group, and someone who had low node status was lagging the group. And then we did things like compute over the course of, this is, say, 72 seconds of that movie you saw, the first 72 seconds, we computed their average node status for the 13 people who are out there. We found something quite remarkable, that there were a couple of people who had something like two standard deviations above the mean in terms of their node status. Kind of interesting. And when we simulated lots of models of particles with a similar kind of rules, with boundaries like walls, we got a much smaller variation among individuals. So, you know, this is clearly, we hypothesize this is a very much a human bias kind of thing, whether people were walking in a certain way or whether some people were kind of more loosely carrying out their rules. Very interesting to try to sort that out. But it does lead one to this question of everybody was given, you know, the same rules, and yet some people emerged in something of a leadership role. Okay, so this leads me, so these topics of sort of accuracy in the presence of noise and heterogeneity and what it means, because some of the things we want to do now is connect, you know, these leadership moments with when the group was really polarized or when it was splitting, all these kinds of things, becomes fascinating. But now I want to talk to you a little bit about nonlinear dynamic models of these things. So this was all meant to be sort of model-free studying behavior. Now can we think about how to reproduce some of these kind of emergent behaviors and do it in a rigorous enough way that we can understand how, you know, a small number of parameters affect behaviors, both so we can understand and predict, and so how we might turn this around into designed rules or even policies for natural groups, how to help, you know, fishery management or things like that. So I obviously can't talk about all four topics. I'm going to talk about the first one, but I just wanted to show you that, you know, there's many, many kinds of problems. The first one I'll elaborate. It's this collective migration problem and the evolution of leadership. The second, if I have time, this second problem is a beautiful problem that's drawn from the honeybee nest selection problem, nest site selection problem, and they do this amazing job of not only picking the best nest site, but also handling deadlocks, and when you have equal value alternatives. This is a really beautiful problem. So this was motivated by some simulation studies that looked to me like some incredible bifurcation just waiting to be described. And so this was a problem where individuals are trying to choose between two possible maybe sources of food, and some have a preference for one, some have a preference for another, and then the rest don't really care, and yet they all want to stick together. And how do they make a choice rather than doing what happens sometimes is a poor compromise, like splitting the difference and going to neither. And then this last one, I wanted to stick this in because these are all equilibrium solutions, but there's lots of really beautiful limit cycle behaviors that you see. This is a problem of collective decision making where individuals can imitate, but then there's error in the imitation. And so you can think about that as these sort of probability to switch from one alternative to another. And this came from the literature on evolution of language, Martin Novak at Harvard. And so we were able to do some really nice things, improve hop bifurcations and limit cycles, and leads to some really interesting possibilities for sort of exploring options before settling on one. Okay, so the story that I want to talk about is the story of collective migration. Okay, so it's going to be related to some of the things I spoke about. And this is this idea of, you know, animal groups have to, for whatever reason, seasonal changes or, you know, where they go for feeding or where they go for having their young, have to go somewhere. And as a group, they want to stick together. So they somehow have to figure out where they're going to go. They have to agree on where they're going to go, and then they have to go there. And so one of the questions that that biologists have tried to understand is, what if it's costly to figure out where to go? I mean, there are all kinds of ways that animals can do it, but it could be very costly. The environment could be fragmented and making it very difficult to figure out how to go where you're supposed to go. It could be that it's much cheaper, you know, just to sort of look at my neighbor's feet or my neighbor's wings and go with a group. But of course, if nobody invests in this costly signal, then they're not going to migrate. And so the question was, what if you just assume? And so this is based on some numerical work. What if you assume just a homogeneous group to start with, and you think about everybody having a strategy which corresponds to, you know, how much, just a scalar gain, how much am I going to invest in that signal, maybe versus investing in the social cues that I'm getting from my neighbors. And if you think about it from an evolutionary point of view, how can you, you know, can you imagine, or what conditions are there such that you'll get this kind of specialization where some will you know, focus on the costly signal, and some will basically turn it off and sort of free ride by just paying attention to their neighbors. And so this is some evolutionary simulation. So this is sort of this. Think about it like a K. This is this how much somebody's how much the one invests versus time. So this is generation number over. So this is an evolutionary scale, and you see that, you know, at some point you do get this specialization. Some are investing, and some are turning it off. And some work was done. So this is work by Ian Cousin and Vishu Guttal, and then Colin Torney and Simon Levin and Ian Cousin did this. Further work to try to understand, using some of the tools from evolutionary dynamics, how might one come up with conditions for when this can happen. And so we got very interested in this, both from the perspective of how can you answer some of the questions that people had. So for instance, in Canada, the caribou have trouble migrating when you build roads, and it was found that there is a hysteretic effect, so you make it so difficult for them to one makes it so difficult to migrate that to clean it up, you can't just clean it up back to where you lost the migration. You have to clean it up even more. Okay, and so can one? I mean, actually, if you could model this with and draw a bifurcation plot, you might be able to see this hysteretic effect. So this is one of the things we were able to do. And the second one was that we were able to then dig in to try to understand the role of the network structure. As to like who would, like if you know, I'm way over here in the periphery, it's probably not a good idea for me to be the one to invest. It might be maybe somebody more central. But certainly if my neighbor was investing, then I probably wouldn't want to, right? So how does that all come about? Okay, so this is work with my now former PhD student, Darren Pice. So the model looks very similar to what we just spoke about in the context of thinking about robustness, except we've added a term. So mu is, say, this true direction. And there's some noise. So the sigma d is the noise intensity associated with measuring that. The sigma S is the noise associated with measuring the Q from my neighbors. So I have this term, which is the social Q. So that's the same, that's the Laplacian matrix. That's the first row of the Laplacian matrix. And this KI is the ith guy's strategy. It's how much they're investing in that signal. So when KI is one, they're neglecting anything about their neighbors, and they're paying only attention to their to this costly signal. And when KI is zero, they're just looking at social cues.
Right.
So this is kind of like the ecological time scale, or the shorter time scale. You know, everybody has their strategies, and then we see what happens. And then the longer time scale is that the KIs can evolve. Okay, so this is, you know, analogous to what these folks were doing. When we look over the evolutionary time scale, it would be the KIs that would be adapting. Okay, and so you can write this equation in terms of a vector equation, which looks almost like what we had before, except instead of just having L here, we have these gains that show up, these matrices of gains. And as long as the deterministic part of the system is stable, convergent, then we know that at steady state, the expected value will be this true direction. And the covariance matrix at steady state, again, can be solved by this linear matrix, this Lyapunov equation, linear matrix equation. Okay, so we can find conditions under which this will be true. So a sufficient condition for stability is that some, we call it a minimal root set. So some number, you know, sort of small number of individuals such that there's a path to every one. If that, each one of those guys is invested, then we have stability and this solution holds. But what's nice, so before we took the trace of the covariance matrix to get the group's dispersion, right? But now, because we're going to be interested in individuals and their own fitness and trying to do the best for themselves and seeing how it evolves and who becomes investors, we want to just pick off the diagonal elements individually. So the, you know, sigma ii, the ith diagonal element, is the ith individual's own variance, how far they are from the true direction at steady state. Okay, and this is precisely, as it turns out, I mean, not so much as it turns out, but what we were looking for, because this is the fitness that our biological colleagues used. So the benefit being this, you know, exponential of minus sigma squared divided by 2, which is, you can roughly think of it as, you know, the speed in the direction of the true direction. And then subtracting off a cost, which is associated with how much I'm investing. So here, C is just a scaling cost parameter. So the higher the C, the more costly it is to invest. Right. And so one can think about these evolutionary dynamics, right? It's now this actually, it's like an evolutionary game. It's competitive, right? Because the landscape is changing. What I do depends upon what everybody else is doing, who around me is invested or not. And so through selection and mutation in each generation, you can evolve the investment of the individuals. And so to use these tools, we typically think about very, very large populations. We had also been interested in thinking about small populations and exploring the role of the structure of the interactions. And so we also took a look at kind of a very sort of simplistic view, but thinking about what if we let this fitness function be a utility function. So we could think about just an individual literally adapting its K to along the gradient to maximize its own utility as a sort of a simple way to look at replication. Okay, so I'm going to show you these two different, I'm going to talk about this for large populations, and I'm going to talk about this approach for small populations. I mean, this also leads me, if I want to think about design too, if I design, say, my robots to have these kinds of utility functions, then maybe what emerges will be not necessarily optimal. That's another whole story, but something that, you know, one might get from evolutionary kind of perspective. Okay, so here's where one can go in the case of very large populations. Now let's just assume everybody is able to connect up with everybody else. Okay, so, you know, sort of like the mean field kind of limit. And so this is kind of applying the standard kinds of tools from adaptive dynamics, evolutionary dynamics. So we let the resident population have the same strategy called K sub R. And so I can compute its fitness, because I can compute from our Lyapunov equation, I can compute the expression for its variance as a function of its KR. And beta has to do with it's the ratio of one source of noise to the other. And then for a given C, I have the fitness for the resident population. Likewise, I can introduce a small mutant population, which is going to have, they're all going to have strategy KM, and I can compute its fitness, that function, because I can compute its variance, and that's going to depend both on KM and KR. And then you can compute what's known as a differential fitness, which is just the difference between these two. And then you can write down the dynamics of the strategy for the resident population like this, by taking the derivative of this with respect to KM, evaluating it at KM equal KR. And a gamma here is just a gain. And so then you can solve for equilibria. They call them singular strategies, equilibrium strategies, these K stars. And then you can look at the various higher order derivatives of these things and determine conditions under which there'll be convergent, what they call convergent stable strategies, CSS. And then among the ones that are convergent to these solutions, there's two possibilities. Either it's evolutionarily stable, which means that the mutant can't take over, or it's a branching point. A branching point means that you can get this kind of specialization. You can get a splitting between leaders or investors and then the non-investors, right? Which is precisely one of the things we were looking for. Okay. And so going through these kinds of calculations, one can actually write down the entire plot here of the bifurcations, so the solutions K star, as a function of cost. So here, cost is growing along this axis, and K star is the strategy. The equilibrium strategies from 0 to 1. Okay. So what happens when cost is really low, it turns out that there are two solutions. One is for nobody to invest, but that's unstable, kind of nice. Instead, everybody invests, and they invest the same amount. As cost grows, they invest less, which makes sense, right? Getting more costly, we're all investing, but we're not going to invest as much as the cost grows. And then you come to this first bifurcation point. Oh, so I should just say that these are simulations of conditions inside here, which at the top, all the initial conditions are starting the same. At the bottom, the initial conditions are randomly distributed from 0 to 1. So this is K as a function of generation, as a function of time. So here you see that everybody just evolves to the same solution here. No matter what the initial condition, they all evolve to the same solution. Then we hit this point here where we have this bifurcation. So now the no migration is now a solution, or the K star equals zero is a solution that's stable. And so we have two stable solutions, and we have this unstable solution in between. And so that's this. So when they all start the same, they all go to the same place. When they all start different, you get some that turn off and some that turn on. And then you get to the point where you actually have the condition for branching. So now you still get, if for the random initial conditions, you still get investors and non-investors, but you also get the case when they start the same that they split, right? This was actually something that they didn't understand when they ran these simulations, how to distinguish between, you know, this case and this case. And then finally, you see the hysteretic effect. So when you get above this, cost gets so big, greater than C2, you lose migration. So the only stable solution, the only solution is everybody turning off their investment, right? And you lose it. And in order to regain it, you can't just turn it on here. You have to go all the way back to here in order to get migration. So that's one side of the spectrum. The other side of the spectrum is looking at very small populations. So I'm showing you n equal 2. So 2 individuals, as small as we could possibly get, and have a little network. But I want to show you this one because you can completely write everything down. I don't have to use Mathematica here. I can just write it down analytically for you. So here are two nodes that in principle could pay attention to each other. But if one invests, of course, it'll become a unidirectional network. So I have these two guys. I can compute, because my Lyapunov equation is 2 by 2, I can very easily solve for the variances. So I can compute the two variances just algebraically like this explicitly. And so then I can draw the same kind of bifurcation plot, though it looks a little bit different. Although, for small values, so again, here's the equilibrium value, this is my K star, equilibrium value of K as a function of the cost, right? So again, for low cost, everybody invests the same amount. It shrinks how much they invest as the cost gets higher. And then there's two bifurcations here. First, there's this saddle node bifurcation. So we get we go from having just a single solution where they're investing the same to having four additional solutions, one where one's invested and the other is not versus the symmetric story. And then there's also these pair of unstable solutions in between. And then I go a little bit further, and I get another bifurcation, a pitchfork bifurcation, and these two disappear, and this investing the same becomes unstable, and it's only one or the other that's invested, which is kind of interesting. And this generalizes, so if you look at, say, this is 10 individuals that in principle could sense each other, but as the k's evolve, remember this is we're using the k-dot gradient climb dynamic here. So then we can compute, now we have this multi-stability for different values of C, and so there's a few of them, the actual simulations plotted for different points here. So for instance, when the cost is big at 10, there's a solution that corresponds to 6 of them investing and 4 not, or 5 of them investing and 5 not, 4 investing, 6 not, et cetera. So here's the example of the 4 investors and the 6 not, right? So very interesting, all these different possibilities. You know, we haven't even yet said anything about what the performance at the level of the group is amongst these, right? So this is actually another project that we're looking into, is how can we marry some, we're doing the sort of the top-down story, like were you given the network structure, who, if you were top-down, who would you elect to be the one to turn on turn on their investment as a function of the network structure? And so can we think about sort of marrying the two? And here's a couple other interesting cases. This is a case of a guy in the middle. So this is a star graph. So everybody can sense him, and he can sense everybody. When the cost is low, the fringe guys invest, and he turns it off. Cost goes up. They all invest a little bit. Cost goes up even more. He invests, and they all turn off. In a ring, you get uniformly distributed investors in this. You know, this is actually something that we can prove that's optimal to have. But as cost increases, you get fewer. But if they're still, like in the case of two, they're antipodal. Okay, so I will just kind of give you highlights of the others, just to give you a flavor of the way in which these bifurcation analyses lend themselves to this kind of interesting matching between performance of a group and simple parameters. And I just love this story. So I'm going to tell you about the honeybees. So this is the story of the bees. There's a new queen. They have to go find a new nest, and they have to get there quickly. But they're going to live there their whole lives, so they want to pick a really good nest site. And so there's a bunch of alternatives. Some scouts go out and find one. Some scouts go out. Let's just say there's two alternatives. Check out site A, site B. The rest just hang out. These two groups come back, and they do this famous waggle dance that many of you have heard about. Just phenomenal. It tells them which direction, the direction of the dance relative to gravity. Tells them azimuthal direction relative to the site, relative to the sun. Yeah, and the duration tells them the distance. It's fantastic, and so they've been able to show through models that what the mechanism is behind them being able to pick the best of N sites. There's this new beautiful paper, 2012. Tom Seeley had done these experiments to try to understand some new signal called a stop signal. So when the scouts from A come back and the scouts from B come back, the A's and the B's swat each other. They basically, whatever rate they're doing the stop signaling, they're tempering the dance of the sort of the opposing scouts. And so we think about this as a cross inhibition. which is phenomenal, because what we've been able to show is that it enables the ability of these groups not only to make really good decisions among differing value sites, but also to handle the deadlock problem. What if the two sites are equal or near equal? They don't want to sit there and deliberate forever, like Congress in my country. So one can write down equations here. So now I'm modeling sort of at the population level. So YA is the fraction of the population that is kind of committed to A, and YB is the fraction to B, and YU is the uncommitted. So the dynamics here evolve on a two simplex. One has a rate associated with when one gets committed. You know, you scout out a site, the recruiting through the dance, a decay, and then this stop signal, this sigma. And so one can write down these kinds of equations, and sort of a standard way to parameterize a lot of these rates is that, they're either proportional or inversely proportional to the value of the site. VI here is the value of the ith site. And the important parameters that we've looked at are this stop signaling rate, we assume it's the same for both groups, the difference in value, and the mean value, so how valuable they are. And so I'll just give you a little bit of a sense of the kinds of things that one can say through studying the behavior of these nonlinear dynamics as a function of parameters. These parameters V, sigma here, I'm looking at delta V is equal to zero. So two equal value alternative sites, but they might be poor quality or they might be really high quality, and then as a function of the rate at which we're swatting each other, right? I mean, what's really interesting is that you take this two-dimensional dynamic, there's a time scale separation. So I talked about under conditions under which these models become tractable, a lot of the things we do have to do with time scale separations, so that, you know, what was this messier 2D problem ends up looking, at least in the deterministic setting, like a 1D dynamic. So they go very quickly to some kind of 1D manifold that we can actually approximate. And then it actually looks very much like decision-making models, drift diffusion or Ornstein-Uhlenbeck type decision-making models, where, you know, if you go across a threshold, then you make a decision for B or a decision for A in this state space. So here, this corner is everybody, you know, everybody is committed to A, here everybody to B, and here everybody is uncommitted. So this is the deadlock problem. I have this stable equilibrium right here, and I'm not going to get anywhere near A or B. And this is for this whole gray region, I'm in deadlock. And in this white region, the dynamics, I've gone through a pitchfork bifurcation. I'll show you the picture. So now deadlock is unstable, and I have two stable equilibria that appeared over close to the choice for A, the choice for B. And what's interesting is it's regulated by the stop signal. And what's really interesting is if they're really bad, you might actually want to wait for a third alternative, or you might require more stop signaling, where if they're really good, you really want to go for one, flip a coin really fast. So this all kind of comes out, and there's even more subtleties. Once you look at near-equal alternatives, it's a whole cusp catastrophe, for those of you who know nonlinear dynamics. It's beautiful. Symmetry breaking, you get saddle node bifurcations. It's really a pretty picture. And here's this idea of, you know, two starting with so equal alternatives moving along. What if maybe there, you know, you tune this stop signaling, increase the rate, and then when you hit that place at which you hit the bifurcation, then one alternative wins out. And this is a case where they were both maybe too poor and you wanted to wait and the third one comes along. So these are stochastic simulations where we put noise on all those rates and you get the third choice. So I don't have time to talk about the other stuff. So let me just stop by just sort of summarizing that the idea here was to talk about analytically tractable nonlinear dynamic models of mechanisms of collective animal behavior, this idea of using bifurcation analyses to provide a systematic look, a systematic analysis of the dependence of performance on some critical parameters in either model environment or the system itself. I would argue that this lays the foundation both for thinking about predictive capabilities, but also for thinking about design, so provable design. So how can we design systems and know how to, maybe these bifurcation parameters or design parameters, and we would be able to prove conditions under which we'd get the kind of behavior we wanted, or maybe systems could adapt them. So for instance, in the first story, the C could be something that that we manipulate this you know, cost, maybe, or maybe something that's coming out of the environment telling us how many leaders we should have under certain circumstances. But wouldn't it be nice if I throw a group of robots in the water and I don't know how they're going to be organized, but on their own they figure out who should turn on their camera, say, to measure something, and not all have to use their battery power, and it turns out to be the one or the two that are going to be doing the best job of, you know, spreading that information rather than somebody who's way in the back or the periphery. Likewise, maybe we think about how this group could make good decisions, thinking about tuning this or adapting this cross-inhibitory signal to deal with deadlocks. The other stories had to do with, you know, avoiding poor compromises and being able to choose when individuals had prior experience or preferences for certain directions. That last story was in this learning imitation and error had to do with maybe a learning story as you get better and reduce your errors. You pass through this place of hop bifurcations into stable, nice stable solutions. Lots and lots of things to think about. One of them I just want to point out is, because I've talked about this evolutionary story, and so one wants to think that the things that emerge from evolution are optimal, but of course we know that they're not. And so, you know, this idea of how do we somehow think about connecting these really lovely stories of all these sort of very powerful strategies that arise from evolution with the kind of things that we like to do, and at least in control theory, is think about optimal and robust. But what's nice about evolution is that they're very adaptable to changing environments, and that's one of the things in design we know very little about how to do. We're really good at doing a really good job on a very narrow objective, but as soon as things change very dramatically, we come more at a loss. So anyway, I'll stop there. Thank you.